Right, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Green Templeton College in Oxford. And we're very pleased this evening to welcome Professor Per-Olof Berg from the Stockholm University School of Business. This lecture is the third in a series that we've been holding over the last few years, and will actually be published in as a unique offering in an academic management journal. Those of you who read that type of stuff, hopefully in the next year or so. So we're very pleased to be able to host an integrated theme of lectures around the very important work of Richard Norman. For those of you who are not familiar with his work, he's a Nordic, so that's quite unusual in the world of management, because we're quite often got Americans telling us what's important in management. So it's quite refreshing to have a Nordic voice. And Richard Norman challenged many of the ideas of Michael Porter, actually, about value chains, with this idea of value constellations, and about the importance of the service economy. And made quite pioneering contributions to the field of management over 2 decades. And this lecture series really is to honour that intellectual tradition, to build upon his work, because his work has inspired a whole range of academic curiosity, further work over that period. And the number of the speakers that we've invited in the past, such as Barbara Tarnaska last year, have been inspired by that heritage. Richard's work, I think, was probably ahead of its time in emphasising the importance of services. I was with an organisation today, actually, and its challenge is moving from a product-based logic of its organisation to a service-based logic. And this type of journey, this type of framing is very important, which connects really to the theme of the talk this evening, which is about the importance of imagination. And Per-Olof will be grasping that theme, taking it and exploring it in some depth, because much of Richard's work really connected with the aesthetic aspect of management and organisation, and about the importance of using emotions and so on to generate those new ways forward. So that's something about the context of the Richard Norman lecture. Per-Olof, welcome. And I'd also like to welcome Richard Norman's son, who's very kindly agreed to be here. So thanks for coming. Per-Olof started his career with military service, which I think, as an engineer,
yes,
and doing military service, and studied business at Lund University in Sweden. He also spent time with US at UCLA and Stanford. He's a visiting professor, has been at INSEAD. And he's done a lot of work on organizational symbolism, and is a leading voice, a leading author in that whole area. I was watching a series, I don't know if you're familiar with it, called The Bridge, which is a thriller about a murder which takes place on a bridge connecting Sweden and Denmark, and which finished recently. And I suppose Per-Olof has some resonance with that, because some of his work actually dealt with the implications of that bridge for the economic development of a region in Denmark, a transnational region. So I feel some understanding of your work from that series, at least some of the tensions between Danish and Swedish cultures, and also the symbolic importance of a bridge in that way. Currently, Per-Olof is chair of corporate and market communications, and he has been back working actively in the whole area of symbolism, the importance of metaphor and so on in management work. So, without further ado, I'd like to welcome you and offer you the stage.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, faculty and students, and anyone else that has been coming in here by mistake, or interest for that matter. And I have to say that I'm very grateful to be here today for 2 reasons. One of the reasons is that there is at least one the dean that has been reading some of my texts. That doesn't happen that often today. And the second thing is that Richard Norman and Partners gave me the opportunity to give this lecture, and it was a very, for me, valuable experience, because I had to get into Richard's thinking again. It's not easy. It takes a lot of energy and resources to get into it, because he's all over the field of management and marketing and strategy, etc. But it's been giving me a number of new thoughts that I'm very happy about. I'm also very honored to be here, because the two previous presenters at the Richard Norman lectures, Pasquale Gagliardi, is personally a good friend of mine, and I consider him to be one of the most interesting scholars we have in Europe, and the same goes for Barbara Szaniawska, who is also a very close friend of mine and is probably the leading scholar in organization theory we have, I would say, one of those leading ones in Europe today. And I guess I hope I'm not here because I'm a friend of those. I've had another reason to be a little bit touched to be here today, and a little bit interested, because I've known Richard, that we honor with these lectures, from 1969. Is there anyone here that has known him longer than that? I guess not even his son. That says something about how young he is or how old I am. I don't know. But at that time, he was my teacher in Lund, University of Lund, in the late 60s, and he was one of those, let's say, very strong, symbolically strong, charismatic figures that gathered a big group of young researchers around him that then formed a very important group. Many of them then turned into academia, others turned into other areas, but he made an impact, an imprint on all of us that still is there today. Later on, he became the first adjoint professor at the department that we created in Copenhagen, Business School, the Department for Management, Politics and Philosophy, where he was very much esteemed. And the last time I saw him was in 2002, when he made, I guess, one of his last appearances, when he was a keynote speaker at the European Academy of Management Conference in Stockholm, which I organized at that time. Okay, in this lecture I will do three things. I will start with illuminating one aspect of Norman's scholarship that is largely ignored, that is his recognition of the role played by imagination in managing and changing organizations. The second thing I want to do is to introduce three short examples, among them the bridge. I'm just going to do it very, very quickly. To illustrate the role of imagination might have in management and business, and they come from a very different area than from, let's say, traditional management. And finally, I will take the discussion one step further into the territory of the unknown, because Richard was one of the few that had the courage to even consider that there was something out there that couldn't be calculated, counted, and predicted beforehand. And this is an area where imagination is king and where magic rules. That's going to be the end. Hopefully the outcome of this rather risky venture will be, if not scientifically path-breaking, at least academically thought-provoking, in if there is something like that, a true Oxfordian style. Okay, let's start with the first part on Norman on imagination. Richard had, who is probably best known for his work or for his conceptual contribution in the area of organization change and growth, his concepts of the business idea that came in 1975 in his dissertation, the idea that the business is based on a conceptual idea of what it is going to do, in what area, what kind of business, what sector of industry it's located, etc., was at that time groundbreaking. It was later the foundation for all the discussions we have today about mission and vision statements, etc. The second area was the one dealing with in service management, where he identified a very particular industrial logics, which is today called in the American style for the service dominant logic, going for the service industry. And he was the first one that could see that and describe the logics of like that. He never, I have to say, that he never liked to be seen as a service management researcher or consultant. He hated it, and he tried to detest it even, because he said that his interest, that was just one of the logics he had identified in life. What's been given less attention is, though, his recognition of imagination as an important faculty to manage and grow in an increasingly complex and chaotic world, or as a driving force behind business strategies. Let me start by examining Norman's contributions in the area of imagination. And I will do that by addressing it on four levels, essentially. The first is on the level of the organization. In what way did Richard use the concept of imagination to understand the organization and its assets and the way in which they were operating? The second is the business environment and the interplay between the organization and the business environment. The third is imagination in strategy. And the fourth element, essentially, is the key or the secret ingredient in making imagination work in organizations by images. The first area, the organization and its assets, that he operated with, based on three main ideas. Because first he saw that when it comes to understand an organization, we have to understand that assets are not a given, but they have to be, in order to understand the true nature of organizations, we have to dematerialize assets. We can see that we are moving now in a society from physical goods to virtual products and services. And this is caused by the new convergent and disruptive technologies. It's based, particularly in this case, information technology. We are in a world of globalization, influences from all over. We are in a world of development of a liquid society with movement, fluidity, cosmopolitan movements, etc., etc. And all those things led to what he called the decommodification. Customer-designed products and service offerings are replacing the standardized products. It led to the unbundling of markets, markets that previously had been controlled and been very stable. Changed overnight due to deregulation. For anyone that has come to Arlanda Airport and wants to take a taxi, you can see a living example what that means when it comes to prices, etc. Finally, he claimed that this has led to the fact that companies have exploded. They have erupted in value chains that might take directions that we had never expected just a couple of years ago. In such a dematerialized world, companies are not positioned and assets are not logically organized in given value chains. Richard hated the concept of value chain all through his life, and he was accused by some, I think it was from Donald Schoen, that all he was writing was against Porter. Porter is the key author that has been connected to the value chain concept. His idea, Richard's idea, instead, was that the organizations are built up to develop and according to value constellation created by the companies themselves, their customers and their partners. The task for the leaders of the organization is thus to imagine and to create the business systems that exploit possible opportunities in the dematerialized world of assets. In his book with Raphael, which sits where, right? He wrote, for example, that In such a volatile and competitive environment, strategy is no longer a matter of positioning a fixed set of activities along a value chain. Increasingly successful companies do not just add value, they reinvent it. A dematerialized business world is also open to rapid and disruptive changes where invaders, that's one of his concepts, themselves create new business systems and also force the establishment to do the same. Pathbreakers open up new value constellation in uncharted territories, and prime movers enjoy the sweet fruits of being the first to exploit new business opportunities. This is a very different way of looking at the organization that we have seen previously. Organizations that are sort of trying to find and pick the assets in a dematerialized world and in a world that's deregulated, etc. The second idea he had when it comes to organizations again was his idea about organizations as an ecology of ideas. Business ideas, growth ideas, personnel ideas, you name it. This can be traced back to his dissertation with the title Management of Growth, for Growth. In Sweden, it didn't have that name, and we had a discussion last night in a dinner saying that Richard never liked his title, his English title, because in Sweden it was called Creative Management, Skapande Företagsledning, for all of you that know Swedish here. Which was much more to the point, because that's essentially what he did. He introduced the idea of the creation, that by defining the business idea of an organization, you actually created the organization and the conditions for its survival, development, and growth. The key idea here is that organizations are built up around dominating ideas, business ideas and growth ideas, that not only describe the organization itself, but also the niche in the business environment in which it exists. Norman argued that it was the ability to define and redefine the ideas of an organization in a creative and particularly imaginative way that determine its competitiveness and in the long run its survival. This is a very clear break from Penrose. Penrose was a very famous author that laid the foundation for the resource-based theory of organization, saying that an organization has its very core is the resources it has access to. Richard's idea instead was different, because rather than competences and structures, he said that it was ideas. It was the idea base of an organization, with ideas, visions, and concepts, offerings, etc., that's the most important asset of an organization. Over time, Richard continued to explore the role of the mental fabric of organizations and the relative freedom of organizations to organize its assets and imagined value constellations, rather than in, and I quote Richard again, assembly-like value chains, according to Porter. The third point, when it comes to his view of organizations, was that organizations essentially were an embodiment of vision. What keeps organizations together in a dematerialized world was vision. In his last book, published in 2001, he clearly stated that the organization is, its competences, its management system, are nothing but the embodiment of the vision. In these cases, it comes back to the power of technological breakthrough must be replaced by the power to envision a reconfigured business system. This vision must then be embodied in new competencies and organizations and management systems. It's not technology that determines the development of the organization, but it is the way in which management are able to formulate the possibilities that's inherent in the environment, the competencies of the organization, in a combination, in a creative way, that is going to be determining. Please note that Norman is talking about, it's not the structure of the, or outline or design of the new business system, but rather the vision of the newly imagined business system. The embodiment of imaginary materialization of the vision was also taken down to the level of the offering provided by the company, even all the way down, and even to its products. In a very memorable lecture he gave in Copenhagen, where I attended, he even claimed that products could be seen as frozen ideas. which is a beautiful, very, very beautiful concept, or a way of explaining it. The second point is the concept of co-produced environments. When Norman published his dissertation in 1975, the environment of an organization was considered as very stable. The role of the company was to develop a consonance between the objective and stable features of the environment and the structure and strategy of the organization in formal organizations. I mean, here you have the Aston School, the contingency theories, giving particular, even mathematical relationships between the characteristics of the organization, sorry, of the environment and the forms an organization could take to be more efficient. We have also the theories about the formal organization, Peter Blau and company, that at that time was at its top. And I will never forget a lecture that was given in Stanford. This was in 1975 when I was there, and he said clearly that the future belongs only to one group of researchers, and that is the mathematicians that can calculate an organization. That was just a couple of, let's say, 5-6 years before the culture boom in organization, the symbolism boom, came and killed those that calculated for that time. Now this goes back and forth, as we all know. Inspired by his research and consulting work, is done in the service industry. Service industry at that time was, this is in the 70s, was basically unexplored, totally unexplored. No one saw the potential, and no one saw the link between production and services. They argued for a much looser coupling between the organization and its environment than had been previously assumed in the contingency theory. His main argument here is that business constellations, that's the business system in which the organization is a part of, is not a matter of fact, but a matter of creation. Something that we are building together with our customers and with our suppliers, and with other that might be competitors at times, but in certain instances actually collaborate with us. And his argument was based on three observations. The first was the one developed was the dissolution of environmental boundaries. Based on his experiences as organizations and management consultant, he could see how customers and suppliers increasingly performed tasks that had previously been done inside the companies. For example, he could also see a collaboration between suppliers, customers, and various service providers taking place inside companies without regard of the organization boundaries. These are things we know about today in terms of open innovation systems, open strategies. We know it, we can see it in IKEA, we can see it in we can see it in the crowdsourcing methodology that's used in for different purposes, etc. But at that time, no one actually spoke about these things. Needless to say, this view, which is mainstream today, was at that time very new perspective. What has not been so recognized, though, is the imaginative or rather creative character of the rebundling process of the environments, all the way to the level of the sectors of industry. He said, for example, that the traditional definitions of industry, industrial sectors, is not valid anymore, but that we need to, we have a situation where we are, where those will win, where those will be most competitive that are able to redefine the sectors. And he also said that rather than competition within sectors of industry, future competition will be about the creative definition of new systems of competition, and from that the creation of new businesses. I'm not quite sure if you're aware of the absolutely groundbreaking idea he's coming up with, because what he's saying is that it's now free for organizations to redefine the very foundation in which they are working, the industrial sectors to which they belong. The environment is a matter of definition, of creation. The second point in this, when it comes to understanding the environment, is the imaginative creation of business systems. Business system was not something given, but something co-produced, that's already what's said. This means that, and Richard's contribution in this area was also to highlight the imaginative or creative aspect of these processes, where goods and services could be rebundled, business systems reframed, and industries reorganized at will. He even claimed that clients seldom exist. They have to be acquired or even created. Another concept he developed was the concept of ecogenesis, bringing forth the world. His idea was that the organization environment interface was organizing, or the environment of the organization and the business system was to a certain extent self-organizing, or autopoietic, as we say it in the fancy academic jargon. And these forces in the business constellations were very powerful. The inspiration for this idea that to some extent the business environment that was created took on a life of their own came from open systems theory. And for those of us that were about that time, the open systems theory with Prigogine, dissipative systems, with Varela, requisite variety, Maturama, and other ones, that was high fashion. And he took some of the ideas, and that helped him to understand the kind of system that he was dealing with. And he took them, and his own take on this was to coin the concept of ecogenesis, the birth of the context for co-dwelling. What he argued was essentially was that the successful creative prime mover could get up on the system level and develop the system in a way that the other ones had to adopt to it. I mean, if you look, for example, at Nokia and Ericsson, at one point in time, they had that position because they were first in the mobile com market. They could write the standards. They could write the basic rules for the development. And this was something that was, at that time, that could be used, and that it was even possible for organizations to create those kinds of ecosystems. The third contribution from Richard was his take on strategy as imagination. His ideas was founded in his critique of the dominant, overly rational view of strategy in general, and the assembly-like logics of the value chain in particular. His main argument was essentially that we needed to develop models of strategy that take the unknown future in seriously and fully utilize the imaginative creative potential of the strategizing process. Because at that time, I mean, people thought that what they could do is that they could forecast. They could draw trends out in the future. And they did not see at a particular point in time, particularly, I would say, according to the value chain's perspective, the creative potential in the strategizing process. Strategy is strategizing. It's a creative process. It's something that takes the organization into the future in a very different way. Finally, when it comes to the strategy, he had... His critique came, or his ideas came in essentially in two areas. The first was the critique again of the rational planning mood. He very early on in a presentation he made in 1969, which was presented in ASQ Administrative Science Quarterly in 1971, he looked into the product development process, and he found that the very early part of the product development process was distinctly different from the later part. Because in that phase of the product development, the manager really didn't know anything. They had no data to project the future, or the data they had didn't work. The models they had was different from the one when they were moved on, because then they could start to develop project management technologies when they knew if something of what they wanted to do, some of the new products was going to work out. That means, and he continued, concluded that manager cannot be guided by models based on ex post facto knowledge. And he particularly emphasized the individual entrepreneurial spirit and the importance of cognitive conceptualizations. This was in 1969. Over the years, his critique of the existing ex post facto planning was developed further in the collaboration also with Raphael and others. They wrote, for example, that forecasts based on projections from the past become unreliable. Factors that have always seemed peripheral turn out to be drivers of change in a company's key markets.
invaders from previously unrelated sectors change the rules of the game of the night, etc. They are addressing one of the great challenges of strategy in our time, that is the challenge to develop models for action in situations where we cannot know anything about the future. And the critique of the SPOC's fact is strategic thinking. The conclusions is that we need to find new or alternative ways to go forward in reverse. The third part, or the second part, when it comes to his view of strategy, was the recognition of the unknown again. Early in his career, Norman came to recognize the fact that we cannot know anything about the environment, about the unknown. That is, there might be situations where management has no clue about what to do, but only know that they have to do something in order to survive. In this kind of situation, traditional strategic planning techniques based on forecasting or scenario planning, whatever, will not essentially help us. Sorry, I know that we will have a discussion about this later on. What is needed are methods that help management to get moving into the unknown, methods that can give guidance for action ex ante, rather than those that are based on ex post facto knowledge. Over time, Norman came closer to accepting the idea that at the core of strategy must be the recognition of the unknown. And in his last book, which in many ways is, as I see it, the most interesting, he developed this figure where he said, this is what the customer does not know, this is what the customer knows, and this is what we know and what we know don't know. And he clearly stated that the most interesting business opportunity lies in the cloud up there in figure 7-3. That's where we have the opportunities. That's where no one has been. That's where we haven't charted the territory yet. That's where we as prime movers or whatever have an opportunity to move. Finally, when it comes to Richard's ideas, Norman saw imagery in the shape of business ideas, ideas for growth, mission and vision statements, etc., offerings, you name it, as the most powerful ingredient in the strategic potion. He tried to understand what is it that works in strategy. And he came up, it's not resource, etc., etc., but it is essentially the vision, the image. And he highlighted the imaginative aspect of the vision. His perspective departed slightly, or significantly, I would say, from those that saw visions mainly as a sense-making mechanism or as a vehicle to see meanings in a chaotic world. His argument was rather that it was meaningless to try to make sense where little sense was to be made beforehand. He said, for example, that true or false, useful or not useful, clear or hazy, we act or choose not to act according to our own perception of reality. If the image is not an exact equivalent of reality, it's at least a social reality. We are building up the image together. Indeed, we should understand that the power of the ideas and images should be found in the way in which they generate new insights, coordinate activities, and mobilize action. So what he did essentially is that he said, don't put too much time into defining the vision and mission. Don't try to put too much effort into operationalizing it, because it is the generative power. It is the power in those visions to make the organization start to move that will be important. Then, as the organization starts to move, we can redefine in meeting with the unknown environment. In his book Service Management in 1984, he took this line of reasoning one step further, stating that the guiding images of an organization could be seen as self-fulfilling prophecies. Images which generate firm, visible, and successful action not only contain an element of the self-fulfilling prophecy, they also exert a considerable snowball effect. The idea is that if people start to talk about the vision and the ideas, it starts to materialize, I'll come back to that later, then it will have a snowball effect because other people are going to do the same. What we have here is a scholar who advocates a view of strategy as a self-fulfilling prophecy and a snowball effect of hazy images. And what is stressed here is not the substantial factual stable, but the assumed power of the imagined. Thus, So this was essentially his view of when it comes to the importance of images. There's much more to say, but I will wait with that till afterwards. Now, this ends my selective reading of Richard's work from the perspective of imagination. Needless to say, many of Richard's observations, concepts, the concepts he developed and trends he predicted have proved to be true over time. It's also obvious that Richard has given the academic world a rich heritage of ideas, concepts, and theories. However, he's not left us with a heritage which is easy accessible or painlessly transformed into mainstream management theory. How do we do with organizations that can be seen as the embodiment of imaginative visions? What about environments that is seen as imaginative co-creations? What about strategy as about the creating images for the unknown and visions that and images that works as self-fulfilling prophecies? What do we make? What way do we make theoretical sense out of this? Now let's take another take and come into the second part. The question then is where can we find inspiration to take the discourse and the role of imagination in management and strategy one step further? Let me start by giving three different examples with a common characteristic that they seem to rely upon a rationale, that is, a controlling principle and underlying reason for thinking and acting, that is fundamentally different from the analytic rationality generally used in management science and research. I'll give you three examples now. We are into the second part of the lecture. The first example comes from the Naskapi, part of the from the indigenous Inuit people of eastern Canada. They would start a caribou hunt by cracking a bone and firing it, a caribou shoulder bone from one of those tags. They carefully marked the direction of the smoke from the ritual fire, because that became the direction of the hunt. In the end, this turned out to evidently to be a highly successful strategy and ensured a strong population of caribous by not hunting always in the same direction. The second is a story told by Carl Weick, who is one of the lead writers within this area, which I think is quite, sorry, I should have, I was a bit. The second is a story told by Carl Weick about a military maneuver in Switzerland. It's about a young lieutenant. This is in the 1800 something. Young lieutenant of a small Hungarian detachment who sent a small reconnaissance unit into the icy wilderness. It began to snow, and for 2 days the lieutenant suffered, fearing he had dispatched the group to death. However, on the third day, the group came back, and after a warm welcome, questions arose about where they had been and how they had made it. The members of the detachment said that we were actually very depressed. We sat down, we were freezing, we didn't want to rise. We were all sure that we were going to die. But, they said, then one of us found a map. And we took up the map and we became very happy, because now we know what we should go. And we started to move, and here we are. And the lieutenant said, fantastic, let me take a look at the map. And he took a look at the map and said, but this is not a map of the Alps, this is a map of the Pyrenees. This example shows the importance of maps not to provide direction, but as mantras to mobilize engagement and action, to get moving together. giving also the opportunity to us who start to get moving to interpret intelligently the signals and signs from the environment around you as you move on in small steps, intelligent steps. The last example is one that I had myself experienced. This was from the Öresund region, the building of the bridge between Sweden and Denmark, and the attempt to create a region. The you can see in the background was the bridge that came to serve as a horizontal totem pole in building an identity in the Öresund region, an attempt anyway. Now the interesting thing is that this was one of the first folders that came out by the consortium that was building the bridge together with those that was trying then to establish the region, saying that the Öresund region exists already, but it does not really exist yet. But the vision of a dynamic development based on faith in the future, new enterprises, new jobs, shared market, that exists. Testimony of this comes from the enthusiasm, activity and atmosphere for expectation that meets citizens, visitors and others who follow what is happening around the Öresund region. So essentially what they are talking here is about the dream. And the only substantial support that exists is that people are enthusiastic, there's a lot of activities and atmosphere, there are expectations. What is this? This is nothing but an invocation. This is a way to try to bring something into being that does not exist. Investments in a dream that does not exist. Let me use these three examples, short examples, in an analysis of imagination in strategy and management, one step further into the unknown, where imagination is king. Businesses and groups today, this is the last part, so then we are going to be over with it. Businesses and groups today must sometimes operate in new or essentially unknowable environments. A striking similarity between these three cases is that they all deal with the problem of moving an organization, be it a clan, a military detachment, or a region, to action in an essentially unknown environment, or an environment over which they have no control. In such circumstances, peoples and groups can and should be willing to rely on models of thought that permit them to act, even though the full cognitive understanding of where they are going, the techniques employed to get there, and the relation between the two are not fully understood. Perhaps it's as simple as saying that the group or the company can and should act when the course is not clear, because in acting there will be observable consequences that help point the way in a continually evolving environment. Another way to say this is that in all the three cases, the will to accomplish something, food and survival of the tribe, survival of the detachment, and the establishment of an international competitive region, and thus the survival of those regional elements, is more compelling. The will is more compelling than the vision of the end result or knowledge of the way to get there. I mean, obviously, when it comes to the shoulder bone examples and the map, it has nothing to do with the reality whatsoever. So the vision that's used is irrelevant. Here, it's also where my discourse of imagination breaks away from Norman's. He focused on the cognitive aspects of strategy, such as how the members of an organization eventually create visions and make sense in a chaotic world, by communication, by discussion, by joint co-creation. But I'm more interested in the cognitive aspect of imagination and related arts as the pretext for strategic action. This will, drive and need to act strategically and to deploy significant resources in confused, ambiguous and chaotic situations, that's the real challenge for us, for organizations today, in the kind of environment we have. Thus, I would take the discussion along the same lines as I used to analyze the contributions from Rickard, starting with imagination at the organizational level, then turning to the environment strategy, and eventually looking for what is the active ingredient of imagination when seen from a cognitive perspective. It's the most divisions when it comes to the cognitive, as we had previously. or the images. First of all, the materialization of imagination. Organizations, and I can say that this materialization, actually the ability for an organization to materialize itself, to become and to create matter out of something that you really did not know beforehand, and of something that we really don't know, can be divided into, let's say, two or three key elements. I think I'll take two. The first one is that organizations has a tendency to see themselves as the nexus in stable business constellations. In a liquid environment, one of the problems connected with this is the misinterpretation of the relative stability and the refusal to understand that it is but a mental construction. That's what Pierce describes as the method of tenancy. That is the tendency to cling to familiar even when confronted with overwhelming information that this is not the best way to act, or even when the familiar may be a harmful path to follow. The map used to get the detachment out of the depressed mood and going in search for the camp demonstrates how imagination, in this case, in the shape of a faulty map, not remotely related to the landscape, not only can unfreeze locked thought structures and behaviors, but also mobilize resources for action. Indeed, in some cases, the process of dematerialization, or how assets locked in frozen in rigid business constellations are set, can be considered almost magical. The unfreezing process, whereby an image suddenly makes you see that the organization is could be rebundled in a totally different way. Another aspect of this is that imagination is a source of variety in organizations. Imagination is not necessarily based on a linear or causal logic, but builds on imagined, sometimes even arbitrary, relationships among images, acts, and outcomes. In this process, concepts, dreams, and images are actually materialized. Of course, in real life, these imaginary images will be shaped not only by dreams, but by different real factors. The true story of the Naskapi Indians helps to demonstrate this. The Bone Oracle came to serve as a randomization tool in the choice of hunting grounds, ensuring a sustainable supply of caribou. Yet to members of the hunt, the Shaw de Boone ritual channels their will to hunt in new territory in a magical way that respects their organization culture, yet moves it forward. Images are not only valuable as generators of variety or effective selection mechanisms, they also have a value of their own. Jim March is essentially saying that to relegate that, a commitment to arbitrary image words has elements of simple beauty in it, and to relegate that commitment to the service of efficient service among disposable organizations is to rob imagination of the irrelevance that is central to its beauty and to its humanity. The very idea here that he is actually arguing is that the introduction of totally different new ways of looking at organizations is a necessary tool for the organization to reinvent itself and to question the existing structure that this is built up. The second thing is that materializations, the fact that you can produce, something is happening, something comes out, is also a manifestation. By producing a result, be it a product, a customer, a supplier, something, from a vision or an idea that is irrelevant, the business idea becomes credible and thus more attractive to investors, suppliers, and anyone else that's involved with the company. Continuous materialization in small steps are necessary to maintain interest in the offering as well in the organization as a whole. If you have a vision but cannot show that it gives a result, then why should you use that vision? In a sense, this is the opposite form of imagination, as in the tale of the emperor's new clothes, you know, where everybody took off every clothes of the emperor, and in the end he was absolutely naked and walked through the street. In this tale, the poor emperor, here the tacit agreement from the beginning might well be that the emperor or official is nude or lacks substance. But the stakeholders have started to dress him up to make it credible and attractive to outside observers and to themselves. This process of mutual confirmation, which is evident in all three of the examples, has been expressed in the following beautiful way. A dream you dream alone is only a dream. A dream you dream together is a reality. Do you know who said that? John Lennon. Another way to see this step-by-step process of mutual confirmation is to see it as a consecutive step of improvisations, in small steps, involving both faith and intelligence. Small clues triggers interpretations. Interpretations are based on experiences, and experiences are based on intelligent interactions with the environment. If you are leading with a faulty map, and you are out in the detachment, then you start to connect and reconnect to your intelligence. You are seeing that on the southern side of the trees, it's more pale, more light than the darker side that goes to the north. You start to make observations of the environment, of where is the rivulets, where are the water, in what direction is it running, and you start to connect to your own experience. And in that sense, the map gets you going, but then you start to connect with the intelligence, and then in this way the two works together. The second point is dealing with environments. To start with, environments are not only much more volatile than we previously assumed, but also more malleable than planners realized. Dake, again, states that, environments often crystallize around prophecies, presumptions and actions that unfold while planners deliberate. Guidance by strategy is often secondary to guidance by prophecy. So the key idea in this sense is that what seems to be, what some of us seems to be arguing in this case then, is that dependent on the attractivity, dependent on the credibility you can build in the faulty map or whatever, you will start to get support for it from the environment, from support to suppliers, whatever it is. And in this sense, it's going to be a crystallization of a business system that, to some extent, this is in line with Richard's, but in this sense, it is based on another rationale, because we want it to become true, because if it comes true, and we know that it's faulty, we know that the map is faulty, the sergeant in lead of the small detachment knew, maybe, we don't know, that the map was faulty, but we used it to mobilize action to get things going. And in this sense, it is the belief in the map, or the faith in the map, that will then make or in this case, in the business idea, that will make people join the business constellation, and the co-creation starts. Investments are made in the idea, and it moves on. Expressed in the other way, the environment crystallizes around offerings that are presented to potential customers, suppliers, and investors. This process contains both the creation of a nuclei around the original version of the offering, and the continuing growth of the system, which is the business idea. The interesting thing is that such a view of the environment means that we have to be open that it brings also forth elements, resources, or forces in the environment to support the cause that we didn't know of from the beginning. And the idea about the crystallization of the environment around an idea or whatever, we can call it, might also mean that the development takes ways and roads that we, who started it, did not intend in any way. When you are playing with this sort of moving into the unknown, there might be things that happens that takes us not only by surprise, but is to some extent also harmful, maybe, for part of the banishment that started it, because it points in another direction that they expected it to move, and might have consequences. The materialization of the dream for the Öresund region in 1990s and early 2000 seemed to have been similar to what I've described here. Investors got spontaneously engaged in supporting in a dream. Political stakeholders gave the support for something that was little more than expression of will to create a region, and there was no way in which this process could be controlled. Let's move now to strategies with this connotative perspective. Let's recognize that in the very end, strategy is nothing more than evoking purposive action, not purposeful, purposive action. That is, direct effect something for a specific purpose. Though our efforts, through our efforts, without actually knowing how it works. This may not sound businesslike, but it is an exceptional human understanding that in a world of mysteries, the least of these mysteries can be our own motivating factors. So in this sense is that we need to find ways in which we can act and get action going. Purposive action. A focus on purposive rather than purposeful action provides a direct link between intent and effect, shortcutting rationally constructed, empirically tested change of cause and effect suggested in traditional strategic thinking. Behind the rationale of this is the assumption of power over things and actions in situations where no maps or guidelines are available or where it's important to impose direct control of and exercise influence over the course of events. So although imagination may well promote action with the help of visions and business-like ideas, it is the way in which the strategic process unfolds step by step that eventually will determine the success or failure of the strategic action. The last part when it comes to the strategy idea is how to view the strategy as such. Let's turn back to the concept of self-fulfilling prophecies as a form of strategy that Richard used. The concept as such, the concept of self-fulfilling prophecies, was coined by Merton already in 1948, and Richard actually referred to that. And it's used to describe the process of auto-suggestions in organization leading to their realization of a desired expression, expressed state in the future. Wright described it this way. The generic process involved is that meaning is produced because the leader treats a vague map or plan as if it had some meaning, even though he knows full well that the real meaning will come only when people respond to the map and do something. The secret of leading with a bad map is to create a self-fulfilling prophecy, that we all believe in it. In the Arizona region, it was very, very clear that what was created was a self-fulfilling prophecy. People talked so much, they gave so much data on the numbers of the region, the beauty of the region, etc., that in the end people believed in it, started even to have faith in it. It's tempting to see this process as mere cause of self-deception, but interviews with key actors often reveal that they are quite aware that they are involved in creating a self-fulfilling prophecy, interestingly enough. This implies that underlying the actor's apparent un- or subconsciousness of the process is not only an acceptance of the process, but also the support for it and its characteristics. It is as many actors want to maintain the fussiness and strategic flux and therefore actively resist attempts to manage the process or to institutionalize it. Freedoms of action. The evocation of imagination and processes that can appear to be magical also enables an active confrontation with problems. The change process is not managed in a traditional sense, but rather stumbles ahead in a series of encounters of actors, clashes of interest, and collisions of ideas in this type of strategic context. Now, what then do we think is the active ingredient if you have this absolutely very different way of looking at strategy? What works? What works then? What is it that have the same power as the images that Richard said? Anyone got any idea? I feel like a school teacher, but I don't like that. What's all this about? What's the active ingredient? If we look at all three examples, it's obvious that none of them would have worked had it not been for the fact that those involved had faith in that it would work and that what they did would help them to survive or to get meat or to whatever. In this way, faith is essentially a way to assume power over imagination, or as McDermott says it, again and again, success depends on energy of the act, how much people put into the act, investors, etc. Energy depends on faith that we shall not fail. We are not willing to do anything if we don't have faith. Faith. And faith is different from belief. And this is where, again, Richard and I are differing a bit. Because, I come back to that maybe in a minute. Faith, in turn, depends on the faith that we are right. And in this way, faith verifies itself. In this way, faith gives birth to will and translates images into action. Thus, it's not enough to create a belief in the venture by communication, etc., but to create a faith in the organizations and its undertakings that can gather its members and realize resources and commitment from external partners. Belief is a cognitive psychological state in which an individual holds a proposition or promise to be true based on the processing of information, and in this sense also communication, an application of knowledge and changing preferences. Faith, on the other hand, belongs to the cognitive stage or the aspect of mental processes or behaviors directed towards action or change that includes impulse, desire, volition, and striving. What sets faith apart from belief is intensity, full assent, rather than mere mental acceptance. In an imagined world, faith that we will not fail is necessary for us to mobilize the energy needed to act. It's the very situations where bets are made that those who believe will be separated from those with faith. Summing up, this lecture has been a too long and maybe too sympathetic exploration of the concept of imagination, as it appears in Richard's text and the way it's based on my own research. There are, of course, also a number of less sympathetic views on imagination, such as McKierney's very well-known book on imagination, where he essentially says, I won't go through that, we cannot be sure which is which. And this very undecidability lends weight to the deepening suspicion that we might well be assisting at the wake of imagination. Imagination is dead. Simply because we don't know who produces and controls the images. They are standardized. We are living in a Disneyfied society where we are living according to ready-made images, and the very core of, the creative human imagination is no longer there. This might well be true, but we can only hope that we will find ways to bring creative human imagination back as an important force in organization life and management practices. Because, as Einstein said it, imagination is more important than knowledge, for knowledge is limited, whereas imagination embraces the entire world, stimulating progress, giving birth to evolution. And it might be right in here that we are then, if we take it the full step out, approaching the field of magic, which is a particular mode of rationality that refers to invisible powers or agencies to understand and influence events, cause changes in the material condition, or create experiences of a particular quality. And maybe we can learn a little bit about the scientific exploration of the way in which magic works in society. I'm not talking about starting to believe in Harry Potter. I'm thinking about a serious scientific discourse of magic as a possible way to understand how we are going to be better at organizing and orienting ourselves into the unknown. Because we find magic wherever the elements of chance and accident and the emotional play between hope and fear have a wide and extensive range. We do not find magic wherever the pursuit is certain, reliable, and well under the control of rational methods and technological processes. Further, we find magic where the elements of danger is conspicuous. We do not find it where absolute safety eliminates any element of foreboding. And have you ever seen a better description of strategy than that?